That's our signal. Now that we're blind, we're ready to start. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for finding time in your afternoon to join us to talk about housing delivery. I'm Lisa Taylor, Chief Executive of Future of London. And housing delivery, I think you'll probably agree, is one of the underlying principles of everything that's been talked about over the course of this forum. We're doing a few pieces of work on it. We had a session with Liz Peace and people from Haringey talking about what's happening on the ground with delivery models. We are doing a piece of work with GVA that includes a stock take of who's doing what across the city, and then a series of roundtables on that in the autumn. Let us know if you want to get involved with that. And we also had a senior roundtable that looked at some of the pitfalls around delivery models. It was really interesting. There were lawyers in the room there, and I'm sure there are today as well, talking about one of the issues, particularly in this case about partnerships, was that people were doing it because the guy next door had one. They thought that the big issue was that they had to have one because that was what was going on. We're going to go a little broader today and talk about housing models or delivery models across the piece, not just JVs and development agreements, but how are people getting things done. And we've got a great range of people to talk to you about what their experience is. I'll introduce them one by one when we get there. But we've got GLA with us. We've got Grosvenor with us. We have Swan, who's doing modular. We have Argent. And then we have Westminster City Council. So I think you're going to have a great sense of what's going on and what the challenges are across the piece. Now, Andrew's in for Jamie Ratcliffe. He actually led on the 2016 to 21 affordable housing prospectus. So he knows about his numbers. And he's also recently spoken in Sydney on affordable housing there, and it's good to remind us all, I think, that not everyone thinks that London's doing a terrible job. You said they were pretty impressed. It was going okay. Andrew, I mean, over to you. What do you think are the main challenges right now in terms of housing delivery in London?
Well, I think in terms of the political climate we've got at the moment, we're going to have to wait until the Queen's speech, which has obviously just been announced for next Wednesday, to kind of find out more and see exactly what, you know, leverage the DUP will be we're getting from that. I think in terms of the GLA and our challenges going forward in that respect, we need to be continuing to work closely with central government to be getting a strong outcomes for London, as we have done in recent months, especially with our record-breaking affordable housing funding settlement from last autumn. In terms of Brexit, we didn't know too much what that was going to look like before the election. We know even less now. But I think it's important to remember that most of the challenges we're facing will be similar regardless of what Brexit will look like. Regardless of Brexit, 25% of our construction workforce will be leaving the industry in the next 10 years or so. So we need to kind of respond effectively to that. Regardless of Brexit, we need to be building many more homes. We need growth. We need about 60,000 homes a year to kind of meet population growth and meet kind of years of undersupply. And I guess regardless of Brexit, we need to be making sure that growth is good growth. That means building not just housing, but many more genuinely affordable houses that meet the needs of Londoners. And whether that's through our affordable homes programme, through Section 106s, or a combination of both, we need to do that. We also need to be mindful that we need to kind of rebalance supply so that we're getting much more market homes coming forward in kind of areas that are lower in value potentially and more affordable to Londoners. In terms of where that land's coming from, it's obviously a challenge in itself. There is land available to London, but it's obviously constrained, and we're going to need to take more difficult decisions as we move forward. Clearly, London, it needs to be more dense, it needs to be more dense everywhere, and we need to be kind of innovative in that. We need to be looking at mixed-use developments in particular. So we need to be taking a good hard look, I think, at kind of single-story, kind of low-density buildings like schools, like retail developments, like warehouses, and working out exactly how we can reshape that provision and, unlocking high densities and kind of housing at the same time.
Good. Good start. I think if we can get all that done, we'll be in great shape.
Right? Hopefully, yeah.
So hopefully. It'll all be fine. Catherine, you're Director of Development with Grosvenor for Britain and Ireland. You're one of the bastions of long-term investment. You've got fabulous blue-chip assets and so on, but your challenges and your approaches are going to be the same for you as they might be across the piece. What are you facing right now?
Very briefly, we're obviously a British family-owned property business, active around the world. And in the UK, our core objectives are growing recurring income and also and addressing two principal challenges currently. Firstly, tackling threats facing the West End. And secondly, we want to help tackle the housing shortage, which, of course, in London is acute. And as Andrew's already said, we agree that it needs some bold and, in some cases, difficult decisions to be taken. So in terms of sort of how we're evolving from sort of Grosvenor in the past and our long-term approach to housing delivery. Clearly we have a 300-year history of creating and managing places, including homes, at scale. And we're now applying that to new urban neighbourhoods in London through investment in the build-to-rent market. And we're starting with a 12-acre site in Bermondsey in Southwark. And there we want to help create one of London's greatest neighbourhoods for people of mixed incomes, backgrounds and life stages. And principally we're aiming to deliver 1,500 mid-market rental homes alongside a whole range of other uses managed by us for the long term. And as many other people in the room will, I'm sure, share the view, we think that the build-to-rent sector has enormous potential to deliver new homes in London. But we do think we need there's a policy change that's needed to unlock it. So thinking about lessons and challenges, I think, you know, there is a case we made about sharing those current challenges. So at the moment, the housing shortage is too often creates polarised outcomes with those who can afford to buy homes and those few who are eligible for and then are allocated social rented homes. And London government recognises that new rental homes are needed for those that are in that middle, currently not provided for. It recognises that the economics of build-to-rent are different to for-sale housing and that rental development can't at this point deliver the same amount of traditional affordable housing as housing for sale, but that it can deliver really meaningful affordable housing through discount market rent homes, which can meet a whole range of local needs. But we think that proposition needs to be discussed more and it needs to gain public acceptance in order to really unlock the sector. And we want to create certainty for the private sector and also trust for the public sector and its constituents. So there are two ways it seems to me that we can do that. Firstly, it's all about creating great places, well-designed, mixed, knitted into the existing community with professionally managed homes for rent. And secondly, I think there is a need for flexibility from boroughs on their approach to planning policy up front so that we can negotiate a means to really unlock the sector. And key to accompanying that is that, is there a need in London for a new narrative as to what constitutes affordable housing and who we need to be delivering that housing to? And so I think once that new approach is agreed and agreed consistently, for us, the principle of a review mechanism in that planning discussion we feel is right for us. And with the terms set in advance and the right certainty, we would be willing to provide more affordable housing if once we're up and running and once we're operational, we outperform our current forecasts. So I think for us, great places and also a transparent way to set a new approach to policy that can capture that outperformance. But they're clearly two fairly large challenges.
It's minor stuff. Minor stuff. One of the questions, of course, is what goes in there and how it gets built and so on and so forth. And that's where I think Swan's being quite innovative now. You've built this factory to create your own precision-built or modular. What word are you using?
Either one.
Okay. So, the basic question is, why did you go ahead and build your own factory, and do you think this is a sustainable response?
Yeah. Thanks, Lisa. I think just to give you a bit of background to the decision. So, Swan Housing Association, based in East London and Essex, existed for about 25 years. Started out with 2,000 homes. Now have about 12,000 homes, and we've been building our own homes consistently through that 20-year period. So it's quite exponential growth if you actually do the maths. And we currently have a development pipeline secured of about 3,500 plots. We were one of the first housing associations to set up our own in-house private development organisation, one of the first housing associations to get into private sale, which was around 16 years ago now. And then we were also one of the first to, and still are one of the few, to have our own in-house construction team. So we rarely go out to the construction market. And now we are probably the first, I think, to open our own modular housing factory, which is in Basildon and Essex. And we're in the process at the moment of producing the first four show homes and pilot houses and getting to full production within the next couple of months. So we're right on the cusp of this becoming a really big thing for us. So the reason I told you all of that is just to set the scene that we are in control of the whole process from beginning to end. And one of the areas where we had less control was in the actual on-site delivery of work. So we had issues with the last phase of the of one of our big regeneration projects out again in Basildon, where we had really poor weather, which really slowed us down hugely, a timber frame subcontractor and an internal fit-out subcontractor both going bust during the construction period, which really let us down and slowed us down. Cost rose as a result of that. And all of those things, we thought, actually, there must be a better way of doing this. So our chair's in the room, actually. So the board sort of set us a challenge and said, not about this. Come up with some exciting things that we might want to think about in the future. So my pitch for an exciting thing was, look, we've looked at modular housing and thinking about doing this for an external supply chain, but how about we opened our own factory? And to my surprise, the board kind of said, yeah, go away, do some more work on it, explore it, and we have. And we're now where we are, and having appointed an MD for that factory, trying to employ manufacturing principles and processes, I think we're in a position where the market is ready, where we're ready, where our supply chain's ready, where digitalisation of the design process has meant our architects are ready to make a real go of this. And it allows us to, I don't want to talk about the Farmer Review and all of that. I think the case is made that we need to increase productivity, increase quality, and improve the timeliness of delivery in housing. So we think we're at the forefront of that.
You've answered the second part of the question. So I think we'll go to Simon and Rachel, and we'll come back for discussion and expand on that. Simon's actually in for Richard Meyer. He's a project manager at Argent, knows his stuff. Actually, Simon and Andrew are on our Leaders Plus course at Future of London, so I've just seen them Tuesday. It's a little weird to see you up here. Another on-the-ground element is the potential threat to construction skills with Brexit or just generally shortages and changes and so forth. You've got huge regeneration schemes at King's Cross, Brent Cross, Tottenham. How do you see that affecting your ability to deliver and what are you doing about it?
So I think, obviously, it's a huge concern, long-term regeneration, and there's a lot of work that has to happen over a period of time, which is also there's quite a lot of uncertainty around it. So even just from our position, we do lots of different types of business planning and scenario testing, and we can easily come to a figure of about 600 homes a year that need to be delivered, and that's ignoring office space, that's infrastructure. So a lot of reliance on supply chain to be able to deliver that. And I think then I think about, well, hang on, King's Cross has done really well. It's actually weathered, as far as delivery, it's weathered a lot of difficulties in the industry. And how has that done so well? And actually, when I think about it, it's done so well because of the partnerships that have been created. So and when I say partnership, I don't mean, we do a meet the buyer event and therefore we know somebody. We actually get really involved with all the organizations. And also those partnerships they range from local authorities, consultants, contractors, subcontractors, suppliers. So really understanding their businesses and their challenges. So I think if you then think about, so what's coming forward, the things we're looking at are different to King's Cross, but the challenges are actually greater. Mm. And I think our approach, and definitely I think it's the right way, is to continue this partnership approach, but perhaps change it slightly and say, how do we push this the partners that we've got, and actually how do we look at new partners who can do things in a completely different way, because what's happening in the industry now requires that.
Okay. Going back for a sec to this construction skills question, so in terms of actually delivering on the ground, and Rachel will come to the sec, just to sort of bottom that out a little bit, how would those partnerships help deliver in terms of people on the ground and so on? Is that just finding the right partners to do the job?
So from actually people on the ground, so it's quite an interesting question because King's Cross has its own construction skills academy, and that was actually one of the drivers from Camden, and I think an interesting statistic from the King's Cross Academy is that I think in 2016 there was 130 or 140 people locally that were given work, so I think that helps to find construction skills in the local area, which is great. But I do think it's quite difficult from our point of view because we're fairly limited. We're quite a small organization. So the partnerships really enable us to go out there and find the individual companies and find out what it is that they want to do to enable us to say, right, yeah, you're the right guys. Let's go and do this project together.
Okay, good enough. Thanks. Rachel. Councillor Robertson.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you, for one thing, what can you do as a borough to help deliver different kinds of tenures and so on that we need right now? But also, as part of that, maybe to react to what you've heard so far as potential solutions or challenges. So,
thank you. Well, for any of you who were here on the opening evening on Tuesday, you will know that Westminster has a very, very clear priority to deliver much more affordable housing much more quickly. We have huge pressures as a borough in terms of the number of people that we need to house. And so clearly we need to do everything that we can to accelerate the delivery of housing. And that actually incorporates a lot of the themes that we've been talking about here, cutting right across the board. We also need to look at the type of housing that we're delivering. So another thing that that Nikki, our leader, stressed on Tuesday evening is that we need to look at the type of affordable that we're delivering as well. We talk about affordable in this big sort of lump, but actually there's a very significant difference. And what we're finding in Westminster, which clearly is unusual in terms of the property values, but I suppose is typical of central London, is that you have extremely high property values. So if you're very rich, you can come and live here. And then we have a lot of social housing as well, around 20%, which is absolutely great, and we need to increase that. But there is a section in the middle, intermediate, which is only 1.5% of our total housing stock, which we absolutely need to increase. And that intermediate section, and we've talked, we've heard here about, you know, the discounted rent, etc., is the section that we need to deliver for the working families, those on lower or medium incomes, because otherwise they're not going to be able to afford to live here. And for the city, what that means is that if we can't have those people being able to live here, then all the people who work in our entertainment industries, which is so important for tourism, our nurses, our teachers, our refuse collectors, everyone who makes this city tick and keeps this city going, won't be able to live here. So we have really, with the new leader coming in at the beginning of the year, I'm new in post in this particular cabinet post as well, we have made a really clear commitment that we need to do everything that we can to accelerate delivery. Now, we can go and talk in more detail about how we're going to do that, but part of it is obviously working with the private sector to make sure that we do everything that we can through for them to deliver their affordable commitments, but also on our own sites to look at how we can expand on that. So infills, we were hearing about different types of construction. We're using that as well so that we can be much more clever and also deliver much more quickly, but also the regeneration of all of our estates. And of course, as we were hearing at the beginning, a large part of that will mean increasing density and possibly increasing heights on some of our buildings. So I don't want to talk in any detail. You will appreciate that Westminster is very closely involved in the disaster response for our neighbour. But let me just say that as we all recognise that in order to deliver the housing we need to increase the density on our estates, our absolute first priority, as it has always been, is to work across London, but really closely with the fire authorities and others to make sure that as we develop different types of construction and different methods of building, that we maintain the safety and are able to reassure our residents that those are the really attractive homes that we want them to see them as.
Thanks very much. I have a few questions, and then we'll throw it open. Do any of you want to respond to anything that you've heard just now? Are you pick up on any points? Okay. The big question, I think, for everyone in terms of delivery, some great ideas here, a good range of thought and challenges and so forth, it's always going to come down to the numbers. We're doing a piece of work on aging cities, and one of the things that's coming out is that to deliver genuinely affordable homes with decent quality for older people that's affordable and viable, it's not necessarily possible. I'm not saying it's impossible, but there are so many barriers financially to getting that done that it's going to be very difficult as that population grows. Any thoughts on what you're seeing that might start to answer some of these questions about viability for large schemes or for smaller schemes? Catherine.
Yeah, I guess, so I've sort of articulated the challenges which we're currently exploring and are very much live. And I guess, as we've sort of heard in various of the presentations there, build to rent, of course, has a huge role to play in delivering new housing at full market rent, and also the discounted intermediate housing that we've also heard about. Yeah. And I think there's a real opportunity with build to rent to address some of these challenges of, you know, the key workers that we've heard about as well, because there's so much flexibility that can be harnessed through a range of discounts, which can be adjusted according to local need, according to local employers' need, public sector needs. And that's one way to really ensure that what is the housing that is delivered can be both viable for the party bringing it forward and also meets a genuine need. So we spent a lot of time really doing our homework, understanding the local community, both immediately around our site and in Southwark, understanding where the pressures are in terms of, in particular, public sector employers who just cannot retain staff, teachers, nurses, except as you said. So I do think there's a real opportunity to solve quite a few problems. But as I said, there is a need for upfront flexibility. And in some cases, that is a difficult conversation, particularly in build to rent. And it's a well-rehearsed discussion that you cannot afford as much traditional affordable housing as private for sale. But there is certainly a narrative and a discussion to be had with the public in London to really explore and really describe the benefits that a different approach to affordable housing can bring for people who are performing incredibly important roles in the city.
Thank you. Jeff, I'm wondering if perhaps precision and modular might be one of those answers, or is it too soon?
Well, I don't want to focus just on that as the only thing, but I will touch on it if I can. Mm. So I think it's important that we have some certainty in the planning system, first of all, about and that's about an expectation on landowners around what they can expect to achieve in terms of the overall provision of affordable housing in a scheme and a mixed community at the beginning. Because it's the thing that kills viability is, or the two things are increased costs or reduced income. And so from a developer's perspective, there isn't much benefit in having a model that drives you only to market sale as the only outcome that makes that scheme viable, therefore pushing up the land value because your exposure to risk is so much greater. So, from a developer's perspective, having a mixed 10-year model on a site allows us to better manage risk and program delivery. So I think a planning system underpinned that and made that either for a tariff-based system, for example, but made it very clear at the very outset that what you can expect to get would be a good start to improving viability. The second thing is obviously, to answer the point about modular housing, it will actually start to save us money immediately on new developments. Over time, because of the continuous improvement that you can make in a manufacturing process by employing lean thinking and all those kind of good things that we can never do on a traditional construction site will allow us to drive the costs down even further and give us more cost certainty. So it removes one of the unknowns in the viability model and therefore reduces your need for contingency. So improves timeliness. So if we can deliver twice as fast, which is what we're kind of expecting for our first scheme, and particularly if you're building for rented accommodation, reducing that period in development reduces your financing costs, but also brings your income in that much earlier. So for all those reasons, I think it can enhance viability.
Thanks. Andrew?
So I think our draft SPG, which came out obviously in last autumn, I think tries to provide some of the certainty you're referring to with the kind of looking minimum 35% affordable, pushing on to 50% as a longer strategic target. Alongside that, we have the funding available that we secured from central government, the £3.15 billion. Not only is that on a tariff based on a kind of affordable home by affordable home basis, but we also want to use that to kind of push up Section 106 levels of affordable housing on Section 106, especially for those developments which are hitting the 40%. And I think as you already said, getting certainty at the beginning of the process does help. It helps in terms of planning, and helps in terms of viability. So I want to go back to the affordable housing which we want to see on new sites and kind of flag up again, as hopefully you've been hearing across the last couple of days, about the London living rent, which the mayor's introduced, based on a third of local incomes. Rents based on a third of local incomes, importantly, including service charge, I think is really important. And I think we like to see that as a real one of the many solutions to helping those key workers who, you know, priced out of potentially shared ownership, won't be qualifying for a social rent anytime soon, or won't be prioritised for social rent anytime soon. It will be good to see that come forward over the kind of coming years.
Okay. Rachel, I might start with you on this one. Just one of the issues that's come up generally, I mean, it comes up all the time, is about the availability of land. Liz Peace is doing a piece of work, as I'm sure you know, for Homes for Londoners, on delivery models, and developers have cited availability or assembly of land as the biggest problem. What would you, I'll start with you, or anyone else wants to chime in, suggest as possible ways forward? Is it more CPO? Is it sort of, you suggested off the cuff, a potential reserve of land that's used for certain things? What would you see?
Well, I mean, clearly, in the central London boroughs, as we all recognise, it's a real challenge to identify the land availability. And that's why, for us as an authority, we are looking at all of our own estates to see how we can maximise the efficiency of those estates in terms of looking at the density of the build. The whole regeneration programme itself is of course very complex and has to be handled incredibly carefully, because we're not talking about cleared sites, we're talking about sites where people are already living. So it's a very complex, long process, but it is absolutely what we have to be doing to maximise the amount of homes that we can deliver. And the other point, of course, is the whole one public estate piece, which is that we need to be working across the piece with all partners. Housing, obviously, we as a housing authority and local authority take the lead, but we can't do this on our own. So we need to be working with other organisations, other public organisations as well as the private sector, but other public organisations, TfL, the National Health Service, all sorts of organisations which have property banks to look at how we can do this. Because, of course, going back to the conversations we were talking about at the beginning, a lot of the people that we need to accommodate are people who are working within those sectors. So let's within Westminster, as every other borough, there's a constant issue of how do we make sure that we employ sufficient numbers of trained care workers, district nurses, other people within the health service. We need to be working with the health service to look at jointly how we can access land and deliver that. So obviously we're very actively doing that on our own estates, on our own property, but we are working jointly with, and this is work that's going on at the moment, and it's very encouraging. I think it absolutely needs to be pushed through, that we have to all work across the piece to, as partners in the public sector, on the one public estate piece.
Gotcha. Simon, you're involved, I mean, certainly in Haringey, in a large land assembly piece of work. What are you seeing that you have found to be successful, and are there any lessons coming from that kind of land assembly?
So I think it goes back to the partnership approach, really. So Haringey is a good example. So we have a strategic development partnership with Haringey, where we have spent a long time discussing, okay, what are the needs for Haringey? How can we help? And actually using that to set land values. What has been quite obvious is that actually outside of the partnership that we have is that there is a lot of land speculation going on. And because of that, I think it makes it really difficult to get that kind of larger scale regeneration, because I think Jeff was saying about planning, like, if people think they could speculate on planning and there is no certainty in there, you end up kind of bidding against people who are basically happy to take whatever pump that might be. And that makes it very difficult for larger region.
Mm. All right, thanks. Anyone want to respond to that or the question generally?
I suppose just, again, Simon, come to that particular point, with our draft SPG, which should be finalised later in the year, we are pushing towards greater transparency when it comes to kind of viability appraisals and assessments, and in particular kind of existing use value, and kind of pushing that. And hopefully if we can get clarity, we can get consistency on that, it should ultimately kind of drive down land values and obviously drive down, kind of, well, bring up affordability.
Okay. Just a last question from me, and then we'll throw it out to the audience. I think from everything that we hear working across public and private, one of the things that's sometimes an irritant, sometimes an actual serious blocker, is the organizational cultural differences between public and private sector, and sometimes housing associations in between, because that's a whole other animal in a way. How do you see potentially getting past some of those issues in the partnerships that you're working on now or as potential? Catherine, you're nodding, so I'm going to start with you.
So I guess from our perspective, we think that being, from the private sector's perspective, just being really open book and transparent is probably the best way to start a relationship, particularly if it's a relationship with a new local authority. Clearly, we've worked with Westminster for many, many years. And also, I think, a willingness to forge partnerships and really work hard at them. So our project in Bermondsey, we're working both with the Department for Education and the EFA to deliver a new school. And we're also working really closely with Network Rail, and we're bringing forward two parcels of land at the same time, which we think will ultimately create a much better place, more employment opportunities, a cohesive environment, which of course Southwark wants to see as well. So I think there just has to be a willingness to invest time in those relationships, and also a willingness to be open book and transparent. And I don't think the private sector should be fearful of that.
Okay. Anyone else want to answer that?
For Swan, we only work in really seven local authority areas. So focusing on those relationships is absolutely key to us and maintaining them. And for any relationship to be successful, there has to be something in it for both sides. So we try to understand the needs and wants of the local authorities that we work with and their particular priorities, and endeavour then to meet those. And that's a kind of, that becomes a very harmonic relationship, really. So Basildon, for instance, where we've opened our factory, we have a really great relationship there with the local authority. They're very supportive of the factory because they're getting jobs and employment and the kudos of that being in their borough. We are probably the largest house builder and developer in the area, and I have a fantastic relationship with the planning committee and the planning process. So, I think that focus, that local focus, getting to understand where the priorities are, but becoming interdependent and recognising that is, I think, how you drive those partnerships.
Okay. Anyone else?
I suppose just to kind of to continue from that, I suppose, essentially, there may be different cultures between public and private sector, but ultimately, and certainly what's come out of this panel, is that we're all aiming and all working towards the same thing, which in London is growth. It's good growth, which is not just more affordable homes, not just more market homes, more generally affordable homes, be it living rent, be it coming through build to rent. So I think that's really positive. And I suppose that's very much what the mayor's been trying to do through his kind of Homes for Londoners board, which you kind of referenced before.
Good. I think it's the pre-soft launch of the Good Growth Fund on the 29th. Is that the soft launch?
I'm not sure the date.
I think we'll open it up to questions. I can't see any of you. Do the lights come? There we look at that. That's much, much better. We've got a question up front. There are microphones coming around. So, gentlemen in the front here. Lady at the back there, we'll go second. We'll do three in a row. So, far back. And do we have a third question yet from this side of the room? Not yet. So, we're going two and then something else. So, go ahead. Say who you are, please. And
thank you. My name is Patrick Schumacher from Saadid Architects. I have a few questions. The first for Andrew.
Let's do one so we're fair. Yeah.
Okay. In terms of the density promise and the constraints on that, so I was wondering if you would accept that we should to take that really seriously, start to look at things like rights of lights, overlooking in particular standards and unit sizes. The moment the smallest units you can build in London is 37 square meter. If you knock that down to 20 square meter, that will also match up very well with modular construction to come in. So that will be my challenge. Is this being looked at?
Who wants to do that? Jeff? Who wants to answer that? Go ahead, Andrew.
So through our innovation fund, which we launched at the same time as the Affordable Housing Fund last year, we are actively encouraging kind of more modular housing to come through. When it comes to design of those units, we're very keen to kind of retain good quality design. We will look at each individual proposal. There is scope just as we've kind of made clear in the SPG, to be flexible when it comes, as long as in cases of exception design. So, I mean, for me personally, space standards are incredibly important, but I can see why I can see why we need to perhaps be flexible, but as long as overall we're making places, we're building places where people feel comfortable living.
Rachel?
Yes, I was going to say, I think there is scope to look at this again, to review the point. But I would say, because clearly we need to be able to house more people, and if there are ways of doing that, you know, young professional people who need, then we should look at that. However, I think we need to be really careful, because on the flip side of that is we have to make sure that we are delivering homes that are fit for purpose, that are safe, that are up to the standard that we would all accept for the people living in our boroughs. So I think there's a balance that we need to be very careful about.
Thank you. Question in the back. Right. Can you say who you are and where you're from, please?
Hi, it's Nicole from Greenland. You've mentioned the SPG a couple of times. Just in the new SPG, there is a review mechanism, where it means that the schemes that doesn't deliver over 35% of affordable housing, then is subject to a review when 75% of the units are sold. And any extra profit made is 60% of that is going to the local planning authority. Whereas from a developer's point of view, and the developers take on all the development risk and put in all the money to make things happen, and where at the end it seems like being taxed quite heavily, and this might risk that some of the developers might just sit on the schemes for a long time instead of delivering it. So how does GLA respond to that?
It's a good question. I mean, clearly the document is still out for consultation, or the formal consultation closed, and we won't be filling it up until towards the end of the year. I presume you have kind of responded to the consultation and made that point. I think ultimately there's a balance that needs to be struck. The mayor was elected on a very clear mandate to maximise affordable housing. And I think we feel that the kind of review mechanism is the kind of one of the ways we can deliver that. I'd wait as long as you made your views clear through the consultation, I think that's all we can really say for the time being.
Anyone else want to throw it? Go ahead.
I suppose from my perspective, if you're a developer that's submitted an honest appraisal of your site and your expectations around sales value, and that derives a level of affordable housing, and I have to say, as a housing association, I'm a strong proponent of affordable housing. So I do have a prejudice here, but if you're a developer, you've submitted an appraisal that says we're only going to achieve 25%, and it's honest, then why are you worried about paying a bit of tax on any overage? If you do exceptionally well and you have to pay a bit more money at that point, well, you know, that's great, because you've done well anyway. So overage is never something I get too worried about, frankly, if I'm in a deal, because if you're paying it, it means you're doing better than you ever thought you would at the beginning.
Good point. Any other questions from the audience? Okay, we have two right here. We'll go one in the front, lady in the front, and then gentleman behind.
Hi, my name's Honey. I also work at Argent with Simon. At the moment, it seems to be that we're building abundance of 1 and 2 bed flats, and it seems to be there's actually not that much family housing being built. Just from a financial viability point of view, it just makes more financial sense to build 1 and 2 bed flats. How exactly do you think we can address this need? Because families are moving out of London. You get, you know, young couples, young professionals in London, get married, have kids, move out of London. How's that going to be addressed?
Okay, go ahead. Catherine, and Rachel, you had your hand up, and then Catherine.
Well, I think that, yeah, there's clearly a huge challenge there. But I think we need to be delivering housing that is responding to local need and where that demand in the future is coming from. And there is going to be huge demand for the smaller units going forward, the rise of single-person households, particularly older single-person households. But there clearly is a need for family housing. I think there are many dimensions to retaining families in London, and part of that is having the right infrastructure that they need, be it schools and other resources. And I think as well, in terms of there's family housing, and then there's also a role for sharing accommodation as well, and particularly when we talk about providing homes for key workers. You know, we need to explore how sharing models, so the larger units can also be made available to those groups, because the opportunity to share is massively beneficial in terms of affordability. And when you start looking at the, you know, the equivalent household income required, you know, at London Living rents to share for, you know, for example, a 3 or 4 bedroom house, it's looking very compelling, and the range of people and households that can be accommodated in that way is vast.
So Do Build Big would have tenure options in terms of how you use that place.
Potentially, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Rachel.
Well, I was going to say, I think the point you raise is absolutely right. We need to look at what is the demand and what is the market that we're trying to deliver for. And it's not black and white. So in some of the intermediate, for example, a lot of our demand is for smaller one bed or studio units. You have a lot of young people who need to be able to afford to live in London. So there's a separate issue there. But certainly when we talk about our regeneration programs and our social housing, the big demand, as you rightly say, is for family-sized units. So there, we are actually selling studio flats and using that money to reinvest in larger properties, because that is where the demand is. So I think you're absolutely right that we need to be able to deliver more family-sized units, but there is also a point, and as it was raised over here, there is also a point, a demand for smaller units, particularly in the intermediate, but in social, absolutely.
Thank you. We'll take our last question. Go ahead.
Thank you. David Fithy and HSBC. Honey's question rather sort of touched on this, and so did at least two of the answers. Is there a consensus on what an affordable rent is? Let's say, for instance, so I can sort of focus it in a little. Let's say, for instance, for a two-bedroom apartment.
Go ahead.
We need to be building affordable housing for a variety of different people, a variety of different households, and that means that some people will be able to afford. Some people, quite clearly, we need to be helping, can afford to pay more than others. Through the new affordable housing program, we've kind of launched. We're kind of promoting, in particular, 3 different products, one of which is shared ownership. But to move to rent, we're delivering affordable rent, London affordable rent, which is essentially capped rents at the kind of the old social rent caps, which can be held in perpetuity. So for certain people in housing need, that is affordable. For others, we've talked a lot about them today. For key workers, we've been saying that people should be paying no more than 1/3 of their local income, inclusive of service charge, and we've kind of actioning that through launching the London Living Rent.
Yes.
A third of net income was what the question was, so that was the answer. So yes. Yes, with a dot, dot, dot.
Yes, okay. With a dot, dot, dot.
Good. All right. Good enough. We're coming to the end. I just want to ask if anyone has any final comments. Rachel, did you want to address that? Or?
Well, I was just going to pick this up because I think the point about intermediate rent is a really important one. And I think you're absolutely right to ask the question. I haven't got the answer, but what I will say to you is this, that we are doing a full internal review in Westminster at the moment about what the right level should be and how we need to address this. As you know, at the moment, it's based on the average income. And at the moment, across London, it's at £90,000 a year is the upper limit of income for eligibility for intermediate rent. Within Westminster, our own housing provider, Westminster Community Homes, is aiming at much lower than that. Properties that are affordable at a rent for people between £30,000 and £40,000, because we believe that's where we need to be targeting. So I think there's scope for a review. It's really important because I think there's widespread agreement that we need to be delivering much more intermediate. And certainly in Westminster, we are very actively reviewing this as we speak. But I think it's a very valid and timely point.
Thank you. Final points? All good? Can you please help me in thanking the panel? Thank you very much. Good discussion.